every single day I feel it.
Artlist IO.
Every single day I feel the pressure. Double up the work, let's make it extra. Working so my mother get a rest, yeah. Working like I never know I'm best, yeah. Every single day I feel the pressure.
Yo, welcome back. That was video. It's your boy C-Rock on the What Are You Made Of show. I got my man Brian Rader in the building.
What up, C-Rock?
Let's go. From Raider's Coffee Talk. This guy I met on Clubhouse. Clubhouse is it's not the same as it used to be. However, there were some really good relationships that we cultivated there, and I'm very thankful for that. Sometimes things go through seasons, right? And then you just take what you got out of that season, and then you move it to the next season, and that's what we've done. I was just in LA 2 weeks ago, hung out with Brian and Owen, and we just had a great lunch and shot the shit. And hopefully, we're gonna be working on some things together here coming up. Let me introduce Brian before you start talking, Brian, because I know I'm not going to get a word in edgewise once you get going.
The second you give me this microphone, it is game over for this guy. C-Rock's like, yo, we got 30, 40 minutes. I was like, great. 30, 40 minutes of me talking and you sitting there like, can I get a word in?
I'll just mute him if I have to. Listen, guys, Brian has 15 plus years of producing and executive production management experience on over 100 hours of digital and network television and produced many films. Most recently, he has been with Warner Brothers Discovery as a finance executive and consulting for other large studios and production companies. We met, as I said, in Raiders Coffee Talk on Clubhouse. This is going to become a podcast very soon. You guys got to look out for this. This is going to be awesome. Brian's network is unlike any other. He likes to help people, though, connect. He's the type of guy that gives back, and this is one of the things that drew me to Brian. Really enjoy that. Brian, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you having me, man. I don't do a lot of podcasts, and no bullshit, I think C-Rock now, what is this, 3 to 6 months? He had an assistant reach out to me. Then I took him to train at Equinox. We were talking about the podcast. Like, I don't just go on people's podcasts. I'm really particular. A lot of people ask me to do it. And to be honest, I was like, let me feel this guy out. And then we trained together at Equinox. And I was like, yo, after we did a little walk and talk, I was like, whatever this guy wants, I'll come on his pod for sure.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. Plus, I paid $50 to do a 15-minute call with you. Because,
what's so crazy about that is you were one of the first like 10 people that paid money that was not in the industry. So for me, it was like direct actor, writer, producer, directors. And C-Rock was like, yo, I want to support you. He gets on the call. And the first thing you said to me was, yo, you don't charge enough. $50, 15 minutes. Like, that's not enough money. So then I was like, all right, cool. And now I charge a lot more, obviously, as time has progressed within the consulting world of like, hey, I'm, building communities and all this. But I'll let you run your podcast, because if I keep talking, you won't get another word in.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But listen, the funny thing about this is when I was going to do that and I paid the $50. See, the way I operate, Brian, and we've had conversations about this before, is that I love to give until the cup overflows. And so a lot of people are wanting to get things from us. So I'm like, I'm going to pay this guy $50 and I'm going to give the shit out of this guy. He's not even. So this is my thing. I operate this way, and it is the most powerful thing I've ever learned. And so.
Yeah. And to that notion, what I've recognized is when people don't pay for your time, they don't respect it. So they cancel on you two or three times to get some, and then you're like, I'm trying to do you the favor by talk to you about whatever it may be, whatever industry you're in. But there is a psychological thing that happens when someone pays for something, because the second they pay for it, they show up on time and usually early. And when they don't, they don't. So that was the first thing that I learned really early on, like not just in my career, but in general, is like, you pay for what you get. That is the period.
Yeah. And Grant Cardone told me, he's like, dude, when they pay attention. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good point.
And they show up and they're excited and they're early to that conversation.
Yeah.
Like no bullshit. The kind of guy that I am, and I know you know this about me in general, which is I was 3 or 4 minutes early to this, which to me, actually in my own, I was late. 3 to 4 minutes, like before something starts, you're already late. You can't set up your computer. You can't get things going. Like, there's a million things that happen, especially in a meeting. So if I'm not 5 or 10 minutes early, I'm late. I'm already late.
Is there a power thing in Hollywood where like some of the people that have made it, they kind of throw their power around by being late on purpose?
I mean, look, I've had that happen, of course, where it's late to a meeting and you're 15, 20 minutes late because you think your shit don't stink. But the bottom line is, like, I don't care how big you are. If you're not respecting my time as an individual to sit there, the greatest asset we all have is our time. Like, more than money, is my time. If you get me on a call, on a Zoom, on a this, on this podcast, the time is of the essence. The second this leaves, I'm on. The second this is done, C-Rock, I'm on another call. The second I'm after a call, I have another meeting. Like, my time is of value. So I spend it wisely. And if you waste my time, I don't want to deal with you. So to be honest, if someone's 15 minutes late to something, right at the 15 minute mark, I'll walk out. I got I got 15 minutes is
I'm a long time.
It's a long time to be sitting in a boardroom, on a Zoom call, in on a phone call. You're just sitting there, da, 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 and you're now you wasted 15 minutes of my time, and then you want that 15 minutes back.
I'm quick. No. I'm a quick guy all around in my life, man. 7 minutes. 7 minutes is my thing, not 15. But, well,
let's not talk about why 7 minutes. I won't talk about that on this podcast and or chime in with your wife, but we'll stay off 7 minutes. But in any event, that really is the truth.
All right, Brian. So look, before we go down a rabbit hole and go any deeper, I got to ask you the question I start the show with every time. And that's the question. What are you made of?
A lot of determination, tons of love, and ultimately just trying to help people. That is literally like if you ask a random friend of mine, like they will say one of those things or all three at any point in time. My determination started super early. I was a kid who was learning. I was learning disabled as a kid. I got into sports really early. So the determination factor was there to like just succeed and get ahead because I had to try really hard at a lot of things. You know, the love is like, I just have a big heart and I just love people. I love conversations. I love connections. I love talking about life and trying to figure out this crazy thing that we all call life. But ultimately, I want to help people. I want to help people succeed. If there's something that I know and I can give back to somebody to help them to move their career forward, to move their finances ahead, to move their business ahead in all shapes and ways, then that's what I love to do.
And it's not only the people that haven't gotten to where you've gotten to yet. A lot of power in helping is people that are further along than you, with something that you can help them with.
Without a doubt.
So let me ask you this. Obviously, helping people, you've learned this is powerful. Is this something that you had a realization? Because you might have always wanted to help people, but when did you learn that there was power in giving and helping?
You know what's interesting is I think that power as a word is a very unique thing. I think you go through periods in your career and your age where at different stages, in different ages, I've had that kind of power dynamic, power struggle, but the honest truth is probably after 10 years from an industry perspective, 10 years after I was into the game already, I was like, ooh, I know some shit. They need that shit. Oh, okay, cool. I can help them with that. I think when you get to a certain place and you actually have the answers, that's when you're really able to help people. And ultimately, even through helping people, I realize shit. I learn every day. Like I may have almost 20 years in this biz, but like every phone call, every meeting, every Zoom, every conversation, every investor meeting, every pitch deck, every budget I do, every conversation about a project, every creative nature behind a TV show, a movie, things in development, things in production, things that happen in post-production, all of these conversations. And it doesn't just happen with the industry people. It also happens with my friends, my family, and my own personal life. I feel like I'm forever growing. And if you're not trying to grow and you're kind of just stale, your life really has no meaning.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now, I want to hear your story. We're going to go back. But before I do that, one thing I wanted to, you know, when you're out there in Hollywood, right? And you went out there, we're going to hear your story in a second. But like, when did you start to feel like you fit in?
First of all, I don't fit in now.
Yeah. But like, I mean, but I mean, you do have relationships with people that a lot of people know from successful projects and all this, and you hang out with them, and you're like one of the guys with some of them.
Sure, but that doesn't mean that like, look, fitting it is like a state of mind. I think for most people, right? I don't look at like, do I fit in or don't, because like that's subjective. Like honestly, I don't think I fit in the industry. I'm a guy who's got tattoos, but I do finance and accounting and production. Like that, those things do not like. I mean, if I went on a Warner Brothers meeting on a Zoom and I busted out my muscles and my tattoos, it'd be the fucking weirdest conversation ever. So like, I am definitely not a round peg in a round hole. I'm a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to constantly do this in certain situations. And you know, that is tricky. That is definitely.
Do you think it's good? Do you think it's good that you're different though? Like that can come out, that can help too sometimes, right?
No, to be honest, I don't give a fuck. Like, I think that's more where the conversation is like, I know who I am. I know what I bring to the table, and I know the ways I do it. You either like it or you don't. Like, there are people that are very timid, they're very shy, but they know information. There are people that are loud and, you know, and get their point across, like me. Maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. I don't know, but I just go about it the way that I've know how to do it. And I think also, as time has progressed, to get back to your question earlier, as time has progressed, the way I go about those conversations and present myself has changed. That has morphed. And that has morphed with maturity.
Yeah.
I was not the same guy I was at 35 or 30 or 25 or any age. We're constantly changing and we're constantly looking and evaluating and figuring things out. And at least I hope people are. Again, like I'm not just like, hey, that's me and that's it. I want to change. I want to morph. I want to be a better person all the time.
Yeah. Look, everybody's got a story. And don't pussyfoot around this, because this show, the reason it's good is because people get vulnerable and transparent. Sometimes they cry. You don't have to cry.
Rock, but I'm giving you a heads up. This ain't some Oprah shit. I ain't crying.
Phil Donahue.
Exactly. I'm down to get vulnerable, but I don't think you'll catch me in that
we'll
state.
We'll see.
But, hey, anything's possible.
So what's your story? Where did you come from, man? Like, tell us the story. Where did it all start for you?
Yeah, so I grew up on Long Island, New York, in what's called the Five Towns. If you guys ever watched Entourage, Johnny Drama was on a show called Five Towns that was named after where Rob and Doug Ellen grew up. Five Towns is very totally mixed. It's mixed from there are people that have, you know, mega millions of dollars and people that don't from an economics status wise. There are people from all different backgrounds. I was raised Jewish. I think you and I had this conversation at Equinox, but like, I didn't really follow religion. All religions, all creeds, all colors, all shapes, all sizes. Like, it's a melting pot of people that most of their great great grandparents came over on a boat from somewhere, landed into New York. Instead of living in the expensive city that was Manhattan, they then moved out to Long Island. I spent a lot of time in the city because my cousins, my uncle, my grandma lived in the city. And so as a young kid, I was going into the city pretty frequently, but I also lived this kind of more like sheltered life, on Long Island, sports, beaches, things like that.
Yeah. Where did everybody go to the beach up there? Did you go to Hamptons or Jersey Shore?
No, Hamptons was fucking way too far. Literally 15 minutes from my house were two beaches. There was Long Beach, Jones Beach. And my family was from a beach called the Rockaways, which is Queens. But, you know, that's where my mom and dad kind of hung out and dated early on. My parents met when they were 7 and 8 and been together ever since.
Damn.
So, like, you know, they were in Far Rockaway. My grandparents had a house in Far Rockaway. I was one of my early memories and photos that I have in my collection. Too bad I didn't send to you prior or know that we were going to talk about this, is a photo of me sitting on their balcony at the beach. And it's me shirtless. I have my bathing suit on. I'm dripping ice cream all down my face, probably 2 or 3 years old. I grew up like, honestly, very fortunate. You know, my dad was a doctor. My mom was a teacher. They were very like straight laced, but they were hippies. And so and my sister was definitely a wild child and she was 4 years older than me. So I kind of got it really easy. Like, they were super lenient, you know, as long as I got my work done, I was in sports. And the second that shit was over, it was like, here's the keys to the car, or here's this, or here's that, go do you. But at the same time, I really did learn the value of hard work. My mom went back to school when I was in middle school. So she got her master's degree, which I saw. My dad went to veterinary school in Bologna, Italy, and studied Italian and worked his ass off to provide for my family. My dad was up like very, very early. He would get up at, 7 in the morning and come back at 8:30 at night and have his bowl of pasta at the end of a hard work day. And like, that was the life that I saw. So I just saw like work was in my family. I was the kid who was like, I worked at the beach clubs and I would get paid racks of cash. I used to caddy for my dad and all his friends on the weekends. Caddy, for anyone who doesn't know, is you're basically a golf gopher and you carry someone's bag 18 holes and you sweat your ass off the whole time. Like, I always had a job. I always had a hustle. And I think that taught me what hard work is all about. And also living the fruits of your labor. You know, we were, as kids, I was fortunate. I went on vacations. My family, my grandma had a house down in Boca Raton, Florida, like most Jews. And we used to just kick it down there for vacations. And like, and I went on other vacations and stuff like that. So I don't know. I lived a very, like, you know, a very blessed life. Now looking back and I see what other people, how they live in different, you know, ways. I don't know. I was super fortunate.
Now you went to Maryland for basketball, but before we get to that, what was the most challenging thing in high school or before that you ever dealt with, even though you had a good upbringing, but was there any, look, challenges make us like who we are, right?
And this will get me vulnerable, but again, I won't cry. I was on the short bus without being on the short bus. Like, people joke around and are like, yo, are you ever in, you know, I was in learning disabled classes through mid third grade from basically right after kindergarten to mid third grade. I couldn't read or write. Like, I legitimately was just, it didn't click. I was one of those kids. And that was my issue. Math was off the charts. You know, understanding other things socially, fully, you know, obviously off the charts, but really, you know, the writing and learning piece was it. And I remember my mom dropped me off at school because I didn't want to go on that bus. You know, I didn't want to go with kids that had all different physical, mental disabilities, all these things. I'm still in touch with a kid that was in that class, who I was a year older, but he was still in that class. They just lumped people within a couple of years of each other in this kind of learning disabled class back when I was young. And mid third grade, it all clicked. And then then it was easy. Then I was in with all my friends and everything was easier. And then I started playing sports in middle school. I played three varsity sports. I played basketball, football, volleyball. Basketball, one of the leading scorers, volleyball captain for all 4 years. I played football and I used to love hitting people. And then my coaches for sports were like, hey, you really got to focus on basketball and you can't play it during the football season, this and that. And then, you know, I went to a basketball oriented camp, during the summers to play ball. I don't know. I think too, my dad was a jock. Like, my dad always played basketball. He was always played golf. He was always into sports and always told me about it growing up. And I think that's where it kind of stemmed from. So I took my frustration kind of out on the court. You know, I took my frustration out on the fields. So after school, being frustrated with school, I was like, because I was not a great student. I was a mediocre student at best. I think I probably graduated high school with like a B average, maybe 85 to 88. Speaking of University of Maryland, I didn't go there necessarily for basketball. I actually went to Maryland because they had a great architecture program. I was an AP architecture, AP art. I was a drawer. And I was like, cool, I could go there. And after my first year, I remember being up one night, it's like 4:30 in the morning, and I'm sitting there after 12 hours of drawing on those drawing boards. I go, this major is not for me. I did play basketball with a lot of those guys like Steve Blake and other people at Maryland. I tore my shoulder. I was then in a fraternity. I lived the frat life kind of, you know, and I got all my friends there. You know, I definitely stay in touch with a lot of entrepreneurs and business people that graduated from my fraternity and my university. There were 10 of us that graduated either the year I graduated or the year before that are here out in LA and all in entertainment. All of us continue to stay in touch. And honestly, every single person that went after it, that came from that university, are very successful, high level, you know, attorneys, development people, actors, like they made it in their own right. And I don't know what it was about college or after, because I have a crazy unique story of how I even got into entertainment. And I'm happy to share that if
yeah, if we'll get, well, we're going to get to that, but ACC basketball, nonetheless, whether you played a lot, it doesn't matter, right? Maryland is a big basketball school, right? When you were,
the year I graduated in 2002 is the year we won the NCAA championship. People were lighting goalposts on fire. Like, it was great, buck wild, crazy. And at that point, I was a senior, a super senior, and still living in my fraternity house. I lived there for 3 years in my frat house. And like, frat row was the place to be. You know, there was no bigger party scene. People were visiting from all different universities. You know, GW, people were coming down to the university to party. Like, you know, it's a 60,000-80,000 person, you know, school. It's pretty big. So
yeah. So I went to Salisbury, which is, for those listening, is a Division III sports school, smaller school in Maryland too, but it was a party school. It was a party school, but Maryland was probably like Salisbury on steroids. You know what I mean? So But yeah, I remember that year, man, we were going nuts and all that. So, yeah. All right. So then you get out of Maryland, you go into, you've been into mortgages, you've been into finance, you've been in all this, right? So
I graduated with a kinesiology degree. My dad was a doctor. I was like, look, I don't want to do architecture. Eventually I declared as a kinesiology. I was like, maybe I'll go to med school. I mean, in a fictitious world in my brain, I'm like, I graduated, I think it was 12 or 14 credits shy of what somebody would need if they wanted to apply and go to medical school. And I got out of school and I was like, there's no fucking way. I think I graduated with 2.8. I barely just got to class and did the work. And I had a girlfriend, you know, half of the, you know, my college, you know, through college. I don't know. I just graduated. And then I was like, oh, this is life. And I went back to some of my boys in New York who didn't go away to school. They lived there. They created businesses. They worked for a bunch of companies. One of my buddies owned tanning salons and hair places. My other buddy was, you know, working at a bank. You know, like all these different, you know, people that I hung out with did go. A lot of them went to universities, and other of them didn't. Like the troublemakers and the people that were just like, "Fuck this! I'm going to go create my entrepreneurial whatever." Didn't. And I came back, and I'm like, well, now what? Like, there's no fucking six-figure job just waiting for me in the wings. Like, it wasn't like my mom or dad was like, yo, go work for John. He'll pay you 50K. Like, there was none of that. So I was like, all right, I guess I don't know what to do. And I'm like, kinesiology? Cool. So I ran sports clubs. I was a sports fitness advisor. I did like New York sports clubs. LA sports club had just opened up. I ran two of their facilities. And I was like, there's no money in this and there's no longevity in this. I was like, cool. So I could, you know, I could pay for dinners. I could get my own apartment. I could do stuff. But then I was like, this is not what I'm meant to be doing. And a buddy that was working there as a sales advisor, not in the fitness side, on the sales side, said, hey, I'm going to work at a mortgage company. And this is back when mortgages were booming. If you had a pulse, they were like, here's a mortgage for $1 million. Like,
what
you
year,
know
what year was this roughly? Because I got in 06.
So right before So I was in mortgages in 03 to 05.
Okay, yeah, that was hot then. Yeah,
paper mortgages, credit score
stated income loans.
Oh yeah, stated everything. Blah blah blah, bullshit. Right. So I went and worked from Wells Fargo for 2 years, slinging. You know, I consider crack rock because I remember sitting behind a computer answering phones. It looked like a beat version of like Wall Street. It was in Queens. It wasn't even in Manhattan. And I was living in Queens. I lived in Queens for part of the time so that I could like do this job. And then my cousin's friend was like, yo, don't you work at like Wells Fargo doing mortgages? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, I'm going to JP Morgan and they're paying me a base salary of X and commission Y and all this shit. And I was like, you don't even work in finance. Well, how the fuck did you get this job? He's like, I don't know. So I said, what's the most expensive office on like, you know, the Upper East Side of, you know, that does private banking also. And I wound up applying. I got a phone call and they were like, hey, can you bring us your sales numbers and whatever else bullshit? I walk in, I meet this woman. She must've been fucking 75 years old. And she's like, I'm the branch manager, but I do the private banking. And I'm like, all right, cool lady. And then I looked at her and I was like, yo, this woman reminds me a lot of my grandma. On it straight up. I was like, I'm going to talk to her like I talked to my grandma and see if this works. So I'm being all sweet and nice and opening a door for her because she showed me around the building and introduced me to people and all this shit. We sit down and I just said to her, like, are you offering me a job? Like, what are we doing here, lady? And she looked at me and she was like, you know what? You kind of sold me on like who you are and what you've done so far. And she's like, da-da. And at the time, I don't remember. I think it was like, she's like, oh, the base salary for people starting out is like 45 grand and it's like $160,000 cap with blah, 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 and this and that. And she's like, you're going to be making six figures. And I'm sitting there being like, well, I was probably making 75 to 90 grand at Wells Fargo slinging fucking, you know, mortgages for other people back then. And I'm like, all right, fuck it. I'll be in Manhattan. So then I get the job. I'm like, well, now what? I don't have any of my series licenses and shit. She's like, well, you take the summer off. I'm like, what do you mean you take the summer off? She's like, yeah, we just pay you to sit home or go to the park and read books. And I'm like, I don't read books. I was like, all right, I guess I'm studying this summer. So for 4 months, I hung out. I hung out in Manhattan. I went to coffee shops. I sometimes sat in their offices. I would show my face once in a while. And I studied for my series exams and my licenses and my brokerage licenses. I think it was three exams. each one was about, I don't know, maybe every 6 weeks. And that was the summer of Brian. You know, if you watch Seinfeld, it's the summer of George where he's trying to party that summer. I literally partied and studied these books, and I'm not a great student, but I passed all the tests. I then worked at JP for 2 years. Another company wanted, after the 2 years of working there, another company was interested in me. I did the same thing and leveraged my relationships, JP and this and that, in banking. And I landed on a set down on Wall Street because I was taking a meeting and I was in a suit and tie. I walked onto the set, met a producer named Peter Falk, who was doing a movie with called I Sell the Dem with Dominic Moynihan and Ron Perlman. And he was like, yo, I got a job for you. Do you want to come back and work tomorrow? And I wasn't going to this other financial firm for 2 weeks because I took a 2 week gap. And I was like, you know what? I could go work on a movie for 2 weeks. Like, that's sick. And I'll go back in time very quickly. But while I was in college and getting drunk and fraternity and that whole life that I just told you about, a buddy of mine got really wasted one night, and I went in his place because he was so drunk and hungover the next day. I booked a national commercial in his place. And so that commercial, which was for IO Digital Cable, I got paid a rack of money. I watched what they did on production, and I didn't really want to be in front of the camera. My goal was never really to act. And then that agency represented me indirectly. They sent back then Polaroids into New York, and I wound up working on the TV show Sex and the City. And if you watch episode 5, season 5, I'm all through the background, hanging out with all the cast, blah, blah, blah. So I was in New York City for 2 weeks working on that. And then I had a flashback to those moments saying it'd be cool to work on production. And I was standing on a set, and I'm like, who's the producer? And the next thing you know, I'm blabbing about who the hell knows what. Guy offers me a job, and I say, I'm going to run with this. And then a couple days later, I think I was telling all my friends and my family, like, I'm fucking done with the financial shit. I'm going to make movies. This shit's fun. And the next thing you know, I was working on the movie for 30 days. I followed an assistant director to go help on another movie. I worked as a production assistant. Then I worked as a PA on a couple things. Then I worked as a coordinator. Then I started production managing, which is managing the whole production. Then I worked in commercials, then reality TV. I was an assistant director, second assistant director. And then I came out to California now 16 years ago. And I've climbed the ranks and worked for studios and production companies and all these different people and things, and built a Rolodex and a relationships and a business. And I consult sometimes. I work sometimes full-time for studios. I leverage my relationships to work on films and TV shows and use my relationships in reality TV to go develop projects. And I don't know. I think that, like, that trajectory for anyone who is watching this, if you ever get an opportunity and where you even think you have a glimmer of, like, I want to go do that thing, and somehow you end up in a situation that puts you there, make sure you walk through that door. Like, don't let that opportunity pass. And I knew that was the opportunity. It was like Neo in the Matrix.
Yeah.
And the door, the whole thing is like, you know, a lime green color, and it's like on you. Like, that was my moment, and I just ran with it.
And how long did it take you to get back to the six figures so that you were making it Wells or JP Morgan?
So it probably took me.
By the way, because while you're thinking about that, a lot of people get held back because they start making money at something. You know, I was in the mortgage business making $700,000-$800,000, close to $1 million. And I hated it. And I was like, this money's got me, man. It's like, I felt like trapped.
You know what's interesting? And I've never thought about, like, what was the timeline of that. But what I will say is the point at which I was like, oh, I can now do shit was when I was working. I think when I was working and I remember having a convertible car that was not like an expensive car. And then the next year I went out and bought a 911 Porsche for cash. I walked in and bought the car outright. And I was like, all right, you must be doing something right. And I remember that moment as like I think everybody does it. It probably happened, if I remember back, maybe in about 30 years old. And or 33 or 35 or year was. And I'm like, well, you must have made a good amount of money that if you're going to do that, because I'm not somebody who, like, just spends money frivolously. But I remember being like, that's my fuck you car. And 2 years later, I was done. I went and got a Range Rover, whatever the hell I got. But, like,
right.
I don't know. I felt like I went through that quarter life crisis. And for me, it was less about the money. I knew that if you have the relationships, the money will come. If you have the connections, money will come. Like, if you do the right things then you don't need to worry that like you'll be financially stable enough to be in the business. But I remember I was scared. Like I was definitely like worried, scared to go out to California. I was excited, but I remember my grandma at the time, she was probably in her 80s, and she was an entrepreneur, created her own knitting stores and yarn. She like did all these knitting stuff for Vogue magazine, all this stuff. She was a very entrepreneurial woman. And she goes, yo, just go. Like, stop with the games. Like, just go follow your dream. And if it goes down and it works, great. If it doesn't and you're a bunch of years in and you realize at least you tried, at least you went out there. So once I came out to the West Coast, I was not going back. My whole family knew that. They were like, yo, this guy's staying.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a lot of people that haven't met celebrities and hung with celebrities, they look at that and they're like, oh, man. But we, you and I both know it wears off. They're just normal people, right? And they have their dreams and they chase dreams. But
for
like,
for sure.
But when was the first celebrity that you met though?
Well, that's
you became close with.
Yeah, so that's the crazy thing is I worked in movies and TV shows. I had celebrities all around me. Like every set there was a celebrity. The first movie I did, Dominic Moynihan and Ron Perlman were there. Like Dominic Moynihan was at his probably peak because he was doing the show Lost. Ron Perlman had already done big movies. Like he was already established. I worked with Heidi Klum. I mean, literally the list goes on. Like
when's the first one that you became close with? Like you had a relationship with, like a friendship with?
You mean outside of the workplace?
Yeah. Well, yeah. But like, you hung out with and all.
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing about this business that I think people have a misconception. Just because you work on a show, just because you work with someone doesn't mean that you have a relationship with them. And also if you're talking about an A-listers, a piece of talent, like they have a life. You weren't friends with them before you started the show or the movie, and you're not going to really be friends with them. Does it happen? Sure. But I think it happens over a much longer time period. You know, you're not just going to work for 30, 60, 90, 120 days with someone on set and all of a sudden you're BFF with them. You definitely have a relationship. But I don't think that it's a situation where like I'm picking up the phone right away and I'm like, yo, so-and-so like that, you know, that isn't really the case.
Yeah. And did you ever, but you've made friends now though. So what I'm saying was, who was the first one that.
I don't want to share who my friends are.
The first one back in the day, like who do you remember being the one that you did start hanging out with outside of work? And it was like, wow.
Honestly, I don't really remember. I don't really specifically remember. The other thing you got to realize when you're working on a project with someone, you're working 12 to 16 hours and that person's going home to sleep.
Yeah.
Like, and as are you.
Yeah.
Like the days are super long in physical production or when you're working set to set and you're going on show to show, they don't have time for friends.
Yeah.
They're filming. When they're done filming the whole thing, then they have time for their family first, their immediate friends. And by that time, it's 6 months, 9 months later, and you're not really friends with that person. Yeah. Now, if you work with someone across an entire season, like you're working through like 3, 4, 5, seasons with somebody, then you start to garner more of a relationship with them like that. But all these celebrities aren't really your friends. Like even the producers or directors, like they don't have outside relationships with these people. Now, when they see them, well, yo, what up? What's going on? But they're not, you know, it's not the same way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think because early on I worked on huge, I mean, massive movies. I worked on, you know, Fighting with Channing Tatum. I worked on Crystal Skull with Spielberg and Lucas, where they were literally 10 feet from me. You know, Shia LaBeouf, when he was coming up, he had just done Transformers. Like all these kinds of names that back then to me, it was like, it's another set. It's another person. Don't get me wrong. I think when George Lucas like asked me, hey, where's the camera set up? I almost shit my pants that day.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, but the honest truth is like, they're just people.
Yeah.
And after you're on your 20th set and you're working with these people, you're like, oh, that person's cool or that's awesome that I did that. But after a while, it's kind of, I don't know. You just get kind of numb to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then your career couldn't have always just been like this. There had to be some moment where you were doubting some things or maybe.
Look, C-Rock, I doubt myself every day, bro. It's not like just because it's flowing and just because there's work and just this. I mean, in the past 4 or 5 years, we've had strikes. We've had COVID. We've had the business has been a shit show. It's not just this. And it never is, no matter who you are. I don't care if you're the biggest actor in the world, biggest writer, director, producer, or someone anywhere in between. We all have those points in our careers where we're like, nah, I don't, is this for me? Can I keep doing this? Do I want to keep doing this? What's the next thing? It's definitely easier for a guy like me than an actor, for sure. Like I'm not waiting all the time necessarily for a paycheck. I mean, people right. pay me, you know, for stints of time, but it's way easier to be a production person or a producer than it is to be an actor waiting for the phone call. Like my audition is usually this, it's a Zoom call with someone and then, or a handshake back in the day. And then they're like, yo, do you want to work on this project? Or, hey, I got this, I need this budget done. Or a studio calling me and say, hey, we have this project. Can you come on it for 9 months or any period of time?
Yeah.
You know, that's more the I would say the case.
Yeah. Now in business, right. We have to promote, we have to get people to know us, and it's not, we can't just sit and wait for things in production and what you do. How do you promote? How do you market yourself when you don't have something going on? Right. Like, how do you make sure you're still out in front, known, and on top of people's mind?
100%. So first and foremost, now that social's so big, doing stuff like this, right. Secondly is talk to all my friends that are in the business. I mean, literally I have endless amounts of friends that work in this industry that I talk on a weekly basis, whether they're very close friends or, in my opinion, kind of surface friends. They're outside my main people that I see and talk to every week, but it's staying top of mind, you know, making sure I'm talking with all my executives at least bi-monthly, emailing people that are on that list and saying, hey, I thought of you and I have this show, this movie, this project. I need financing for this. All my network executives and studio executives, making sure I'm grabbing coffee with them or having a Zoom or touching base with them about what's going on with them at the studio. All of these things. I mean, honestly, I think my relationships are the reason why I got the jobs I got. The studios I worked for, the people I worked for, the relationships I built, it's because I just kept top of mind. And when something comes about, they're like, oh, I'll call Brian. Okay. You know, that's, I think, where I have probably far succeeded any other person that does what I do in the ways in which I do it.
Yeah.
Is because I do those things where other people, I don't think, do them in the same way. You know, yeah. I'll message someone on their birthday. I'll you know, like I'll do things that most people are like, nah, I don't know if I should do that. Or, you know, I'll send them a picture of us 10 years ago working on a project and we're, you know, arm and on and we're young and we got more hair and whatever. And it's like those are the things I think that, you know, people want, you know. Or I'll ask them what's going on in your personal life. Like the people that I have that I consider close, I know everything about them. I know their kids' names. I know if they got a dog. I know, you know, what sports they like to play. What do they do on the weekends? Do they have a car that they drive, or do they like motorcycles? What's the name of their dog? Like, these are the things and it's twofold. One, I do it to understand and better get to know someone. But two, it's because I really just want to like help people. And if they tell me something about their life, usually it opens a doorway into me helping them in some way, shape, or form, yeah. Whether it's business related or not.
Yeah. Now, Brian, as we wind down here, I want to get to this one topic here. So when we were talking in LA, I was talking to you about the benefit of what you do in entertainment versus an actor, people yeah. in front of the camera, is yeah. that you can translate what you do into the real business world if you ever had to, which is powerful, right? Well, so that
first and foremost, I'm the greatest salesman on the
second.
Like ever.
Second.
Exactly. But no, seriously, like I literally am the type of guy, both personality and in the way in which I get to people, where if I needed to make money and I couldn't be in entertainment and I just sold anything, I could sell anything to anyone. You know, they use that ice to Eskimo fucking analogy and all this shit, or, you know, Wall Street, sell me this pen. Like that is innately in me. So because I have that as like a backbone, whether it's in finance or fitness sales or, you know, the kid at the lemonade stand or all that shit, like that's just in my nature. I honestly think I get it from my dad. My dad has a huge mouth, big personality, you know, life of the party, talks to everyone. And I think that that's kind of where I got that. And from my mom, I got this love and this big heart and this helping people because that's what she does. And that mix of those two things is the reason why I think I'm really successful.
I got to meet your parents, man. I love the description of them.
That's awesome. Come golf. You'll be my friend.
Oh, definitely. You know that. That's the case. All right. Last question here.
What's up?
Brian, what's the vision from here? If I could snap my fingers and make it happen, yeah. right? What's that vision look like?
Yeah. You don't have to snap your fingers because I live it on a daily basis. So you don't have to snap the fingers because I am doing that. They say like walk the walk, talk the talk, put those feet. I mean, that is what I'm doing right now. You know, I'm building things that could be legacy things that I can leave behind. I'm working with people that I trust, that I respect, that are players in this entertainment space. I'm connecting with all my friends that are doing that, that I want to have those relationships with. The ultimate thing is I want to create the coolest projects with the best people and do it in the right ways. And if I do that, then I am successful.
Yeah.
And in whatever ways that is. And that is the honest truth. Like the money, the fame, the fortune, the riches, the all those things that people usually gravitate to me at this point in my career, I don't give a fuck about them. Like I care about the connection point with those people and ultimately helping those people with their projects or with whatever they have going on so that they're more successful. And if the more people I help, the better it'll be. As someone once told, I forgot who I was watching it, and I don't remember what celebrity or what thing. And they said, well, what do you want? Who do you want to show up, or how many people, or in what ways when you die? You know, like, what is the legacy that you've created? And honestly, I'm not worried that at that point, there aren't going to be droves of people and or people talking at that point on whatever the new social media is, because I am that guy, because I've touched so many people's lives in so many ways. And that is why I'm in the industry.
That's why I vibe with this guy, folks. That's why I vibe with this guy, because we roll the same way. Brian, and he's not lying, guys. He, you know, listen, West Hollywood area, it's just phenomenal, man. When I go out there, I just feel different. At Equinox in West Hollywood, you're there, you know, the locker room situation. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's you if I will, so no, my gym, no, I'm not trying to hate on my little gym over here that I go to in Ocean City, Maryland, okay? It's filled with old people, and, you know, I shoot the shit with the old people, but there ain't nothing like the Equinox of West Hollywood.
There isn't, but there's also just an energy in West Hollywood, Beverly Hills, and dead center of Los Angeles. You can't explain it. You can only be there and live it. But when you're on the street and the sun is shining and you see Restaurant Row and you're looking at, you know, people roll up in nice cars and you know, good food and good friends and conversations and people excited and people smiling and people healthy and people, you know, tan and, you know, I'm a little red. I laid out yesterday at my pool. Like, that is the LA life. And when I came here, I was like, palm trees, women, fast cars, good food, entertainment, sign me up. I'm in.
Yeah. I got to say one more thing, because I know we're running time, but this is important. Yeah, okay. You stopped drinking recently, right?
Yeah. So,
can you tell us about that and what it's done for you? So since you stopped 100%. Drinking.
So at 30 years old, I went to my doctors. I was a 10 to 15 drink a night, you know, alcoholic. I was no joke, especially it started in college and then it just followed me right after into my 20s and in New York City. You know, I was working crazy hours and I would just get smashed at bars right after I was off sets or with my friends, my college buddies, all of this. And at 30 years old, after I was in LA already a couple of years, I quit cold turkey. I remember I had, you know, sweats for weeks on end and detox and all this shit that you have to go through. But from 30 to 38, I think I had a massive transition, and I can honestly say it was because I don't drink alcohol. I then was like, yo, I think I could have some glasses of wine with friends. It's been 8 years. I'm all good. And the honest truth is I couldn't. I tried. And my uncle, who was like a second dad to me at the time, had passed. And I kind of went down the rabbit hole with smoking cigarettes again, drinking again, popping pills here and there and things of that nature. And it's in my blood. It's in my DNA. Definitely is in my family and stuff like that. So, you know, I had a rough 6 to 9 months. And then I did the same thing all over again. I quit cigarettes, quit alcohol, put nothing in my body, you know, went through the detox. And now I'm like four years, 3 months and 20 days sober again. And honestly, I wake up every morning and I'm like, thank you. I did not drink last night. And I feel good. You know, I feel healthy. I'm motivated. I'm moving. And I can honestly attribute to the things that you put in your body. You should really, I mean, I urge every single person, I don't care what you do for work. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your background is. If you audit what goes in your system and you only put the best fuel in your body, you will see you turn into, you know, the dopest Ferrari ever, full blown speed. But I could tell you what, you put that shit in your body, whether it's alcohol, bad food, whatever, you turn into a garbage truck real quick.
Yeah, man. Thanks for sharing that, Brian. That's the vulnerability that I was looking for. Hey, man, Brian Rader, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me, Brian.
Yo, thank you, C-Rock. I appreciate you, brother.
All right, guys, you've been listening to the What Are You Made Of show here live from That One Studio. It's your boy C-Rock signing off. Until next time, be that one.
Music licensing reimagined.